This week in Retronauts, we return to the Manitoui. I did that just to wrinkle you, Bob.
I just got to that character.
She's the worst.
Shawit.
Shawit. Shawit is like Dr. Wily in Mega Man 8.
Oh, that was
Dr.
a decision.
Dr. Light.
Who signed off on that?
I don't know. Yes, everyone. Hello. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this is Retronauts, and I promise we will not baby talk like Charlotte for this entire episode. But good Lord, what a choice. What a choice. Anyway, hello. Who's with me here to talk about this stuff?
It's the original Rabbite man, Bob Mackey.
Wow. A Rabbite and a man?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And Kat Bailey, editor-in-chief of US Gamer.
I don't have anything pithy to say about that. yes, anyway, so this is continuing our journey through the history of Square Enix, Squaresoft, I guess, actually, at the time.
No Chris Kohler, alas.
No, Chris, he's off being a father or becoming a father again, doing important family things, and, you know, that comes first.
He was expelled from our little village after discovering
He'll return once he gets the baby sword, and, yeah, anyway. Chris will be back in future episodes, but right now he's out on parental leave. So respect for that.
That's what you get when you're in a union. Pro-union propaganda up front.
Exactly.
I support the Kotaku union.
Yes. Likewise, even if it does mean Chris is not here right now. Anyway, so this is an episode, like I said, that continues our Square thing. And I feel like the last time we touched on this series was like 3 years ago almost, wasn't it? Like 2017?
I think so. And I must apologize up front. I'm wrong about many things. And one thing I was wrong about was saying Seiken Densetsu 3 will never come to America in any form.
How could we have known?
I was almost positive.
So many opportunities. It took 2 years after that collection came out for Switch in Japan for it to come here. Like, it's just baffling and inconceivable.
I still can't believe that I could play this official translation on my Switch, and it was happening in front of me. Yeah,
it's here.
So I apologize. I was wrong, but you understand how I thought I was right.
It took it's a great collection, too.
Yeah. It took a long time for them to get that baby voice for Charlotte just right.
So many rewrites.
All right. So, yes, this episode, we are tackling Seiken Densetsu 3, which we now no longer have to use a Japanese title for. We can call it Trials of Mana. And we're tackling this episode. Following after Trials of Mana, there's Legend of Mana. We're going to hit both of them in this episode, just like we did in the previous Mana episode. This episode comes to us kind of by way of KSO through Patreon. So thank you, KSO, for requesting this topic and giving us an excuse to revisit the Mana games or visit them for the first time, as the case may be. The other sort of element that brings this episode into existence is the fact that not only did we get the original Trials of Mana for Super Famicom, Super NES on Switch last year, we are getting a full 3D remake of the game this month as Trials of Mana for PS4 and Switch and Steam and maybe Xbox One.
You know what game I'm probably not going to play?
Trials of Mana?
The full 3D remake of Trials of Mana for Nintendo Switch, PC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And why is that, Kat Bailey?
Because I have a cool sprite-based 16-bit version already on Collection of Mana. Why would I play the 3D one?
Well, I think we'll talk about that in this episode because there are some things about the original Trials of Mana that kind of wrinkle me and I...
Rankle a lot of people.
Rankle.
The word of the day is rankle.
It is. It's wankle.
God.
We got to stop this.
You monster.
Sorry, it's been a long weekend and there's no more oxygen left in the recording vault.
And we're drinking whiskey mules now?
We barely started on those. I don't think that's an excuse. No, there are some quality of life improvements needed and I really hope the remake includes those. Because if it does, then it will be an objectively better game than the original. As much as I do love the exquisite sprite art in the first game, like the old game, and the even better art in Legend of Mana. Like if they do a 3D remake of Legend of Mana, that is an exercise in missing the point. You do not You do not put polygons into that. No, sir. It is hand-drawn and beautiful.
I'm still salty about the Secret of Mana remake. That's why I'm
Me too.
Very hesitant about Legend of Mana or Trials of Mana.
Trials seems much more comprehensive.
Yeah,
Secret of was really just like, you know, let's make everything the same but in polygons and also bust the combat a little
this
bit.
This may sound blasphemous, but I'd rather have a more ambitious remake like Trials of Mana than a 3D ugly version of Secret
absolutely.
Of Mana. Like,
oh.
Mess with that game more.
I can rant all day about that remake. It was not good.
If the Secret of Mana remake had been comprehensive, that would have been great, but it was super phoned in and very disappointing. I gave it a pretty harsh review, I think, for Polygon, and I have no regrets because it kind of sucked. And I love Secret of Mana, might have heard in our last episode.
The reason I'm hesitant is like the Secret of Mana remake kept everything that was bad or that everything that didn't quite work in the original Secret of Mana. And you're just like, okay, so what's the point of a remake if not to improve on the original in some way, to take the everything that was great about the original and then find a way to build on it?
Mm-hmm.
And that remaster, whatever the heck it was supposed to be, utterly failed at that. So I'm kind of circling the Trials of Mana remake hesitantly.
Hoping it does not circle the drain. So let's just dive right into this because we have two games to talk about and also a soundtrack that we have to devote some attention to because that's the actual patron request. So let's talk about Trials of Mana, a.k.a. Seiken Densetsu 3, the third legend of the Holy Sword in the original Japanese. This game came out for Super Famicom in 1995 and for Super NES. Never, because, I think there's lots of reasons. A lot of people say, oh, Secret of Evermore, that game sucks because we got that instead of Secret of Mana 2. No, we got that incidentally, and also Secret of Mana 2 never came here, but Trials of Mana, sorry. I think these are unrelated facts. Secret of Evermore might have been a little bit of a salve for not getting Trials of Mana, but...
Well, the rumor is that the script literally could not fit on the cartridge because it was such a big game.
I don't think that's a rumor. I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, we should talk about kind of what the design of Trials of Mana was about, but it's a much bigger, more ambitious game than its predecessor. It kind of takes one element, I think, of Secret of Mana, which was an element they intended to have more of in the game, and then ended up cutting because the game was shifted from CD, the Super Famicom or Super NES PlayStation platform, to cartridge, and they just lost a ton of stuff. But you can see a vestige of this in the early going of the game where there's like four or five different ways you can team up with the girl Purim or Prim and the sprite Popoy. Like, you don't have to do it the same way every time. You can take different paths and you can go through events differently. And eventually you'll end up with both of them in the party, but you can kind of have this dynamic, adaptable way of playing and have a different experience each time you play. And that's pretty neat. And that's really all that you saw of it in Secret of Mana. And I really feel like with Trials of Mana, they really wanted to take that element and build it into the basic fabric of the game. So they scaled back some of the elements of the, like the mechanics, the combat and so forth, in favor of giving you a lot of different ways to experience the storyline. And as a result, there's a lot of variable text in the game and there's just a lot of stuff in the game.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, Japanese, when it's written, is a much more compact language. It takes up much less storage space than English does because you're working with – it doesn't matter. Anyway, it's just more compact. And when you translate a game from Japanese to English – and you have limited ROM space, you end up cutting out a lot of content. We saw that with, you know, famously with Final Fantasy IV, Final Fantasy VI, with Secret of Mana. Like, there are new versions, new translations of those scripts that have been produced through the years that don't really change anything of the game. But what they do is they bring the full Japanese text into English, and it adds so much more context. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, I understand what's happening in this game now instead of kind of having to guess at it. And I will say that, you know, Ted Woolsey, who did a lot of the translations on those older games, did a great job of taking a lot of Japanese text and smooshing it into, you know, the limitations that he had for the Super NES cartridges and making it fun and readable and fairly coherent.
And spelling Phoenix with an F.
Sometimes you just gotta.
Yeah, only so many characters to go around.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Well, there was a lot of text in this game. And I know that because this was a huge fan translation release in August of 2000. Like so many – this game defeated so many translation groups. But one group like cracked the encryption on and the compression on the text because there was too much text for the Japanese release. So it was all very much compressed using complicated compression techniques that they had to figure out. So this is like one of the white whales of that era of emulation. Like, oh, we translated this game. And I played this game for the first time 20 years ago when this translation came out.
Right. And, you know, the fan translations could work because they were for emulators and they could be for different sized Super NES carts, but to have a cartridge that was big enough to contain a fully localized English script for the game would have been a $100 cartridge. And that's just unfeasible, especially for the fact that it would have been a 1996 game when the Super NES was in its twilight and people were saving up for an N64. It just wasn't worth it for them. And, you know, games like this are a big part of the reason that Squaresoft said Nintendo 64 is going to be a cartridge-based system? Well, we can forget about that Final Fantasy VI SIGGRAPH 3D demo that we did, you know, targeting the N64 hardware because now that we know it's cartridge-based, we don't want to do this. We want enough space to put our stories and our worlds and our characters, and you've got that on PlayStation with a CD format. You don't have that on N64 with a cartridge format. So long, Nintendo. It was a big backstab betrayal, but an understandable one.
Now that this is out in America, in English, on platforms, I kind of want a collection of the Square late SNES Misfit RPGs that never came over here. So I want a three-game collection with Treasure Hunter G, Treasure of the Rudras, and also Bahamut Lagoon. Live Alive was like 94, I think, or 93.
It was, but we missed out on it.
I'll put that on there, too.
I also want the Romancing Saga games. Let's just get them all.
Get them all on there. I mean, yes. Romancing Saga 2 came out, right, in some form?
Saga 2 and 3 are both out on modern platforms.
So this is all happening. Like, this could conceivably happen, but
Romancing Saga 3 actually got more promotion and hype from Square Enix than Saga Scarlet Grace, which is a brand new game.
Yeah,
Bahamut Lagoon is the game I want.
Yeah. I mean, those were all fans translated, so people can play them now, but I really want to see, like, let's get these on Switch or something because, like, apparently, I guess there's a market for it. Just like, here are lost games, lost RPGs.
Well, this one is tied to the Mana series, so it has, you know, that fondness and that memory, kind of like, hey, it's a Final Fantasy spinoff, sort of. I don't know that Treasure of the Rudras does.
Treasure Hunter G.
Yeah, I feel like those are a hard sell for Square Enix. It took long enough for this game to come out. So I don't know. But
at the same time, the Mana series is sort of coasting on fumes from Secret of Mana nostalgia from just the SNES game.
Weird is that you would think the Mana series would be a lot easier to translate into modern terms than a lot of Square Enix's games because it's an action RPG, for heaven's sake. What do people love most in RPGs right now? Witcher-style games, where you're in a big open world with action combat. You would think that the Mana series would translate into that kind of environment really smoothly. And if you gave it the kind of the right art style, you hit on a lot of the same themes, you had an open world, you got a blockbuster on your hands.
Yeah, I mean, I could see a world, a universe in which exists a Breath of the Wild style Mana game where, you know, the character designs are perfectly rendered 3D versions of Nobuteru Yuki artwork. And it's just beautiful and has wonderful music and there's like a bloom effect on everything and it's just so green and lush and there's little Raybites running around and you can capture them and make them your friends and they'll fight with you.
Jeremy, I hate you right now because I want this game so much.
I'm sorry. We'll just have to settle for the Trials remake.
You didn't buy all the mid-2000s Mana games. You're being punished.
My fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't buy Donna Mana, the game where they were like, what if 3D and also Havoc physics? That's what we play Mana for.
The RTS is bad. That's bad. Children is not bad.
No, Children's fun.
Yeah.
It's not basically like
amazing.
Diablo.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah.
If you don't mind me rewinding back to 2000 really quickly, it's funny because we just recorded an episode about the year 2000, and it occurs to me that is when console game hobbyists were really starting to flourish in such a big way where they were taking these games that were kind of white whales and really give them the appreciation that they deserve. They did it with Final Fantasy V. They did it with Seiken Densetsu III. We were now at a point where consoles were old enough and their fans were old enough to have nostalgia for them and to appreciate what had been missed. And Seiken Densetsu III is a huge example of like that time period.
There was such a sense of, if you want to get modern with it, FOMO about this game, because magazines would show off screenshots. The famous battle with the pumpkin monster in the forest is the thing that I remember. Like, you always saw that screenshot because it was so detailed and so beautiful. Like, there were 2D RPGs and games on PlayStation that did not look this good. It's like, how did they get that out of a Super NES? Oh, my God.
For a lot of, like, younger RPG fans, there's also a sense of injustice. Like, I love all of your games. Let me buy this. Let me play this. And then they're just like, no, it's behind another country and behind another, like, language you don't understand. So it just felt unfair for people who just wanted more RPGs.
And more than any other console, the Super Nintendo always looked amazing in screenshots because you could just use your imagination to be like, wow, this game.
Yeah, you could see the things in motion in your head. You could hear the music, the soft kind of filtered, sampled music that was going to go with it. And you were just like, oh, I bet this is going to be so good.
I used to page through Nintendo Power Issues because I didn't have a Super Nintendo like during its heyday, just like salivating over the pictures and the incredibly detailed sprites going, man, what would it be like to actually be able to play all of these games? Oh, my God.
We'll never find out, except we will now because we have this game. So there's one of them down. All right, so I talked about the complexity of Trials of Mana, but let me explain to the listener who may not know, or maybe they do, but they can just hear me talk about it anyway, what that means. So basically, Trials of Mana, instead of being the story of a kid who finds a sword and then meets a girl in a sprite, it's the story of one of six characters who live in a different kingdom throughout the world, have a different place in life, have a different skill set, different powers. It tells each of their tales, and you can play the game six different times. It's kind of funny because I mentioned this in Secret of Mana, the Secret of Mana episode, but Akitoshi Kawazu, the Saga creator, did not work on any of the Mana games until Legend of Mana. But I still feel like these games kind of have his fingerprints on them. Like, there's a lot about Secret of Mana that's kind of like, hey, it's a... It's kind of Saga-ish. And then this one, you've got six different stories that you can play. That is so Saga.
I was surprised when I looked into this to find out he had none of his fingerprints on this game, because I feel like maybe internally this director was influenced by Saga, but it's so Saga-y, right down to the systems that are very fuzzy and often important but often not important at all. Just like there's so much Saga stuff in this game.
I mean, we'll get to that with Legend of Mana for
sure.
Oh,
God, but, yeah.
but basically, the six characters kind of work in pairs. There's a male and a female character per pair. So there's really basically like three main story paths. Each of the paired characters starts in a slightly different place from the other, but they have a very similar story. And so basically no matter which of those characters you play, you're ultimately going to take the same path through the game and fight the same penultimate boss. Like everyone fights the same final boss, but the next to last boss is different. And there's three of them, and so kind of the pair that you pick, the character that chooses which final boss you take.
Does each character have a unique prologue you play through? Because I know that the other characters, when you meet them, they're like, okay, here's my story real quick. Let me join
you. Yeah, so basically like the characters I've spent the most time with are Reese and Hawkwind.
Oh, me too.
Or Hawkeye, sorry.
Yeah, me too.
Hawkwind is Ultima. And both of them, you know, they end up fighting a guy called the Dark Wizard or a thing called the Dark Wizard. But Reese is a Valkyrie who is very much a part of an established kingdom and, you know, kind of like the noble kingdom that everyone looks up to, whereas Hawkeye belongs to a ninja clan, so he's more working in the secrets. So each of them basically has their own starting point that sets them off into the world, but then they'll meet up at some point. And in addition to the main character you pick, you can also choose two companions. So if you play as Reese and choose Hawkeye as one of your companions, then he'll be like, hey, here's my backstory. Now let's go have this adventure together. And there'll be more interactions with between him and Rhys and, you know, the main antagonist that you face. But if you choose not to have Hawkeye in your party, then Rhys will meet him at various points and he'll be kind of present, but he's not going to be part of your party and participate. So it's you get different dialogue from your companions.
When I ran into Charlotte on the road, I'm like, oh my God, did I choose this character? Are they joining me? And it was like, no, this is just one of the characters who you see along the way, like doing their own thing.
Yeah, you meet all the characters, but only two of them will go along with your main character. And the other three will be off someplace else doing stuff and occasionally intersecting with your path.
You said earlier that you kind of see shallow reflections of what Seiken Densetsu 3 would become in Secret of Mana. And I really do think that in being able to choose from all these different characters and have your story kind of unfold fairly differently depending on who you pick is a reflection of, like, they finished Secret of Mana and went like, well, that wasn't quite what we had kind of hoped it would be. Let's do it right this time. Like, let's dump all of our big ideas into Seiken Densetsu 3 and truly make the game that we want to do.
Yeah, it's a really big game. Like, I recently played a lot of Trials, and I was kind of astounded by how long it took me to make progress. Although,
me too.
I feel a lot of that is because it's really hard to get around the world, and you do a lot of backtracking, and it's really frustrating because I'll end up going back to the wrong city, and I'm like, oh, God, how do I get to this other place? And then you have to, like, go by foot to another town, and then you have to take a boat, and then you have to go by foot, and then you, like...
Or it's like, I have to come here at night. Okay, go run back to an inn where I can sleep and then run back out to where I was. A lot of backtracking. A very big, ambitious game that's hard to navigate.
Yeah, yeah. It trips over its own feet sometimes. But, you know, you can't blame them for being complacent. Like, I would rather play a game that goes big and fumbles than a game that is like, I don't care. I'm just going to do the same crap over and over and is okay.
I don't know.
Doesn't make any big mistakes.
I think I would have liked the simplicity of a more refined Secret of Mana more than what they did here, because I feel like they really were overcorrecting on what they felt was probably an unfinished game, where up front in this game, they're like, almost too many choices and too many factors and too many variables, down to like I have to choose like what stats to level up when I level up. Like, I'm like, I have no idea what any of these things mean or like what this character needs in the future, like things like that.
Strength makes you stronger.
Yeah. Well, other things, I mean, are a mystery. Then I was reading like agility doesn't actually work in the game, or like one of the stats like doesn't function because the math is incorrect. And the reason I did not finish this game in 2000 was I didn't look up ahead of time which paths take my characters down, and you can kind of screw yourself if you don't know from the beginning, like, here is the way I'm going down these paths and growth-wise.
I'm pretty much the opposite. I felt like I really liked the added complexity and layering and all of these systems. I tend to get bored with more straightforward experiences, I think, and Secret of Mana ultimately, like, I think that it tells a pretty solid story and the mechanics are good at, but for whatever reason, it couldn't quite hold my attention. And admittedly, I did not play Secret of Mana until actually quite recently, I think. So maybe I went into it with different expectations than somebody would have who played it on the Super Nintendo. Because you played it on Super Nintendo, right, Bob?
I played it originally like in 93 when it was new.
Okay, yeah. So I mean, you know, in 1993, Secret of Mana is this incredibly gorgeous cinematic experience on the Super Nintendo. It's just a very different kind of situation, I think, than when playing it in 2019 or whatever.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think there are cases to be made for and against this game. And, you know, again, I feel like that's a sign that they were really trying for something. And
yeah, I admire games that really go for it. And I think that Seiken Densetsu 3 really goes for it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it really does, again, get back to the fact that they ended up defecting to PlayStation after this, because you can really see like they wanted to do a lot with this game, and this is very much the kind of game that they would be making on PlayStation with a lot of content. And it does feel like it was really hampered by the format, by the cartridge. Like, this should have been a 16-bit game or like, you know, a Turbo Duo game or a Sega CD or something, not a Super NES game.
See, the thing I think is interesting is I was kind of lionizing Pokemon Gold and Silver for having a day-night cycle and a weekday cycle. Trials of Mana had that stuff well before Pokemon Gold and Silver ever came out.
I mean,
it's pretty awesome for an action RPG.
It's not real time, but it is a huge improvement over or a huge addition to Secret of Mana, where it's not just day night. It's like there are days of the week. They're not Monday through Sunday. It's like the different elements are.
And it's before Ocarina of Time as well.
It's way after Simon's Quest, but it does a lot more with day night. Like Simon's Quest, it's basically like you can't talk to anyone at all at night, and there's zombies in the towns, and enemies take twice as much damage.
I mean, it was an ambitious and interesting idea,
right? But
too clunky.
But here, it's more like, hey, sometimes there's a secret market that only opens at night, or you know, certain days of the week are affiliated with a different elemental sprite, and so
additional memory lets you do things.
Yeah, well, it may be an enemy is easier or harder to defeat on a certain day of the week. And, you know, sometimes zombies do come out at night, but it doesn't necessarily make all the other enemies harder. It just means some of the other enemies go away and are replaced by the undead.
I just want to add that I propose that Mana Day be a new national holiday in the
U.S. I'm fine with that.
I want that. Do I get off work?
Yes. We get to sleep in for free. Hotels make no money. So there is a lot going on. In addition to recent Hawkeye, there are also Angela and Duran. Angela is a mage who is like the sexy character. I don't know if you've seen the new character designs they've given her for the remake, but it's all upper butt. Duran is a mercenary. I think he's a really popular character. People always seem to really like him. And then you have Charlotte and Kevin. Charlotte is the miserable little troll of a child who talks like this. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate because she is the best healing magic user. So basically no one ever has healing magic in their party because why would you play with Charlotte in your party? And then there's Kevin, who's really cool. He is a beast
what a name.
Man.
Kevin the
it's
Beast
not,
Man.
Yeah, Kevin the Beast. I don't know. I like the mundanity of his name. Everyone's like, Reese, Hawkeye,
Kevin. I'm sure we have many Kevins listening.
It's me, Kevin. I'm a monster.
But he turns into a beast at night. That's, you know, so there's another impact of the day-night cycle. So, yeah, each of these characters have kind of their own story, and their stories cross paths with the other characters. Sometimes the other characters, even if they're not in your party, will help you out or they'll, like, offer your advice. So they put a lot of thought into this. It really crisscrosses and interweaves with the other characters. You basically go through all the same places in the world depending on which character you are. Like, they all see the same sights, but each location has different significance for other characters. So, like, one place might be just, I found a beach. Who cares? For another character, they might wash up on the beach and be like, oh, I got shipwrecked. Wow.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. So, like, you know, depending on the collection of characters you play as, there's a lot of different ways to experience this game.
Is it fair to say that Reese is the most popular character?
I think Reese is great. I don't know if she's the most – I think
– She seems to be dominating the fan art and
okay,
the general
well, I
references.
Mean, fan art is one thing.
I see that. I see why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing. But also, I mean, popular characters tend to dominate fan art as well.
Yeah. Actually, I would think for the lewds, Angela would dominate because she like sleeps in the buff and stuff like that. I was like, is she actually – oh, yeah. Okay.
It's right. Quite a sprite.
Hey, there
quite
you go.
Sprite.
I love 16-bit RPGs that actually do this, apparently.
Another element of kind of the variety here, in addition to each of the characters that you have, the six characters, each of them has multiple subclasses. As you play through, once you get to like level 18 and then again like level 30-something, I think, you have the opportunity to go to certain places in the world and choose to basically enter a prestige class. And the prestige classes have light and dark alignment. So for your first level up, you can go light or dark. And then for your second level up, your final form, there's like a light, a neutral, and a dark. So the skills you have available and the statistics, the stats that you wield, they're very different depending on which class you choose.
I think it changes your colors too, the colors of the characters
as
well.
Yeah, in the remake, you actually get new costumes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You change a little bit visually, but you also have like a completely different skill set depending on which path you travel.
Reminds me a little bit of when you kind of get your second jobs in the original Final Fantasy. You go to the next level, but in Trials of Mana, obviously, like you have more choices in that regard.
Yeah, so you can play with sets of three characters from a pool of six, and each of those characters can take one of like three or four paths through their classes. So that's a lot of variety. You don't ever have to play the game the same way. Although people are like, oh, you should play this, this, and this because it's the best way. But I feel like that's not very fun.
I feel like you should do some research ahead of time just to know what you need to do, because like I said before, when I first played this, I was kind of screwed because I didn't have what I needed. I wasn't leveling people up in the right way. And I think this game is designed for lots of trial and error and lots of replays, not for the modern context of it being more user-friendly. So well, I did ask on Twitter before I started up again.
That gets down to, do you think it's a bad thing if a game is better enjoyed by having lots of supplementary material and guides? And I don't necessarily think that it's a negative if a game is murky to the point where you feel like you need to find a guide or find
help. Yeah, otherwise, how do we ever play MMOs?
I mean, like, one of my favorite games is Darkest Dungeon. And yeah, you could spend a lot of time experimenting and learning how to play with all of the different systems. But I think a mark of some of my favorite games are the ones that just have wikis and wikis and wikis and fan forums and everything full of just stuff that I can kind of crawl through and go, oh, well, that's really interesting. Look at all these interesting choices I can make.
Yeah, I think it's fine to have a game where, you know, it's like be forearmed with this, you know, forewarned, armed in advance with this knowledge. But I'm not really crazy about the walkthroughs for this game. They're like, you should always play as this character and go to this class and use this spell. Like, that's not fun.
That's the frustrating thing about a lot of these guides, is that a metagame will start to develop where people just go, nope, this is the only correct choice. We're just going to poo-poo the rest of the characters. And
as a competitive Pokemon player, I feel like you know a few things about that.
Just a little bit. And you get away from experimenting, which is the depressing thing. So in that respect, I think that culture can be bad.
In this case, it's like it's hard to prototype new groups because it takes like 30 hours to get to that point. So you lose a lot of time. But luckily on Twitter, when I asked, they're like, okay, here's the group you want to use if you want to break the game. Here's the group you use if you want to have like good spells. Like, people are giving me different options. So you can, you know, look into the game breaking party, which I chose because I kind of want to break the game. But
what is their game breaking party?
It's Kevin and Hawkeye and is it Hawkeye or Hawkwind?
Hawkeye.
Or just Hawk?
Hawkwind is a band and also a wizard named after the band in Ultima.
And so Hawkeye is the most boring character in Avengers.
It's just Hawk then, right?
Yeah, sure, just Hawk.
Just Hawk. And
it is Hawkeye. Or maybe in the new, like the official translation, it's just Hawk.
Yeah, I think it's just Hawk. Okay. And then Reese. Mm-hmm. And then there are different paths you took for those guys, but I wrote them down. I don't have them in my brain right now.
But
that's right.
So Trials of Mana plays a lot like Secret of Mana on a fundamental level. Like, it's a real-time action RPG. You have two AI characters. You choose skills and spells and items with a ring-based menu that pops up over your characters. But fundamentally, there are a lot of changes. So each character in Secret of Mana, each character can use any of the eight weapons. Everyone here specializes in a weapon. Kind of like in Secret of Mana, characters are either, you know, like attackers or healers or mages, but it tends to be a little more varied. Like, you only have one character who's really good at black magic unless you subclass specific ways, and that's Angela. And then Charlotte is the natural healer who gets the best healing spells, and then everyone else has kind of different variable abilities. But there are some really big changes. Like, in Secret of Mana, holding down the attack button would cause you to not attack. You would charge up an attack, and then it could go up to like seven levels, and then you let go of the button and you would unleash this attack and probably miss an enemy, but if it hit, it would always do big damage.
It was fun to watch the different animations for each level because they're very elaborate.
Weapon.
Yeah, each weapon too, yeah.
But here, holding down the attack button just causes you to auto-attack, and it's not as effective as just mashing the A button to attack. So it's kind of a lame way to go. The advanced attacks happen based on a meter that charges up during combat, and once that maxes out, then you can set one special ability in the menus and activate that special attack, and you'll pull it off by hitting the special attack button. But again, only once the meter is built up from you being attacked or from you landing attacks or, and so forth. But an even bigger change is that in Secret of Mana, basically you could walk around and you could swing your sword or spear or chakra or whatever at any point, chakram, to attack whether there were enemies on screen or not. Here, that's not the case. If you try to attack when there's no enemies around, you won't do anything.
So yeah, it's more modal. I love cutting the grass for no reason in Secret of Mana.
You can't do that. So you can actually be – like there are barriers here like grass that you would be able to cut through in Secret of Mana that actually block off areas now. And you can't do anything about it. So it's only when enemies appear on screen that you enter combat mode. And the special attack meter that you have only charges while you're in combat mode. So once you like go to the next area, you zone out – then the special meter resets. Mm. So you kind of have to use up your special attack meter within that time. Also, treasure chests only drop from enemies at the end of an area's combat. So once you've defeated all the enemies in a screen area, then the treasure chest will drop.
You still beat the hell out of them though, which I like.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And sometimes they beat the hell out of you. The mimic chests are very powerful in this game.
Yeah, the traps are
alarmingly.
Much worse.
Alarmingly.
Yeah.
This game's hard in general.
Yeah.
There are some very strong enemies.
Yeah. For me, I found that if I did not have Angela in my party, I would be in big trouble because she has magic spells that can hit enemies that are really hard to hit otherwise, and they'll hit really powerfully. If I were just relying on melee attackers, I don't know what I'd do, at least in the opening areas. You know, once you start to subclass, it's different. But, you know, kind of tying into this modal element of combat is the fact that you don't have large sprawling areas of the world anymore. Instead, the world is broken up into much smaller regions. So basically, instead of having an area that's like, you know, 4x4 screens that you can freely roam around, there'll be like 2 screens wide and 2 screens tall, or 3 screens wide and 1 screen tall, or just 1x1.
Maybe a product of the limitations given how much they've had to cram into it.
It could be. I don't know. But to me, like, this is one of the big points against the game because it really breaks up the world and makes everything feel very, I don't know, like it's stuttering almost. Like it feels very like broken up and not smooth. And it's frustrating because it makes traversal of the world much more difficult because I just like, where am I? All these little connector screens look the same and I get lost.
And it's moving the combat towards like just being a brawler, which is what Legend of Mana is, which I don't really like that much. It's not quite there yet, but it's reaching for that.
So that's kind of like the big overview of the way the game works. But there, the interface is a mess. When you get into the menu and you're trying to choose stuff,
interface wasn't great either.
It was fine.
It's so much better. I'm sorry that we're both yelling at you, Kat. But
no, please do. Okay. Just keep yelling,
Kat. You're so wrong. Let me explain why.
I'm not trying to yell at you. I'm yelling at the game because
me too. I'm angry at
the
game because I'm thinking like there are ring menus that are fast and efficient in this game, but there's also a lot of the functionalities offloaded to this slow as hell menu that is just like there's lag on it for a Super Famicom game. It's crazy. And it's not fun to navigate at all. It's just everything should be rings. And I realized the rings weren't like the best way. It was very gimmicky. But the best thing about the rings is that they were fast. And like you can zoom in and out of different like levels of functionality in the game.
But they buried so many screens deep into those rings and it just felt like they didn't really optimize the UI at that time. So you would have critical functionality that you would end up getting lost because you were like, oh, what does this ring do? Oh, especially equipment was such a pain in Secret of Mana.
I honestly think it's worse here.
It is, actually, because you can only do like one character at a time and you have to like back out and reselect, especially if you want to like switch weapons around and stuff or buy stuff for other characters in a shop. It's so cumbersome.
Yeah, I like the metaphor of like every character has their own ring that pops up around them. And you still get that, but only with magic and items, not with anything else.
Yeah, so some kind of steps backward in terms of usability and fun. And I really hope these are quality of life improvements that are included in the remake. I really want the menu interfaces and stuff to be better, to be smoother and less frustrating. That's what I want. Thank you. Anyway, I think you move ahead 5 years to Legend of Mana, which was released, I guess, in Japan in 1999 and here in 2000. And it really feels like they just took all the weird stuff about Trials of Mana and said, let's really go for it. Did you happen to play this game when it was new, or did you come into it later?
Okay, so the first time I ever heard about Secret of Mana was from Nintendo Power. And I may have mentioned that I didn't have a Super Nintendo, so I missed that one. But then I have a PlayStation. And Legend of Mana comes out in 2000, Summer of Adventure, if I recall correctly.
That's correct, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I'm going to totally get this game. But all the reviews scared me off because they were like, this is a weird game. Like, what the heck's going on? It's kind of weirdly nonlinear. You're building a world or something. I'm like, well, this doesn't sound like a game that I necessarily want to play. So even though I was very much in the mold of I'm buying every Square Enix game, that's one that I ended up skipping at the time. And it wasn't until quite a bit later that just out of curiosity, I ended up getting it and trying it out. And it definitely was weird, but more interesting than I first let on. And I think it's kind of a weakness of like the reviewers who are looking at the time were like, what is going on? This isn't straightforward. This is too crazy. So yeah, it's kind of seen as a black sheep these days, but
yeah, I feel like we as gamers and critics have more context for understanding what was happening in this game now. At the time, it was just
well,
so
it was like,
outside
it's
the norm of what we played in the U.S. and what we got in the U.S.
I've tried it recently, and it's still very inscrutable.
Okay.
It's just a badly designed game, and I would say this game does not deserve like the presentation and the music it has. I feel like, and reading research about this game, apparently it was like Ishii was asking for more time, and they wouldn't give it to him.
Yeah.
And he was like, "I'll do what I can to finish this game." So the game, like fundamentally, is just like a work in progress, just sort of wrapped up. So I can see why that led to problems. But
so like everything, though, Legend of Mana has its stands who are going to go to bat for it forever.
It's very true.
They love making them some golems.
They love they love talking about the crafting and how important all of the placement on the world map is and everything. Like, no, there's so many systems.
But none of them are really important. That's
no.
The problem.
Have we moved on to Legend of Mana in earnest?
We have, yeah.
Okay, I just want to mention the director of the last game, though. He was the guy who was exiled from Square after making a disastrous version of Final Fantasy XIV. So Ishii did not direct Seika Densetsu 3. It was that guy.
Yeah.
And he was at Square since 1984. Like
Hiramichi
a really interesting
Tanaka.
History, yeah. But he was exiled from Square.
Wow.
Yep.
Dang.
He was like a vice president. He was a bigwig, but mm-hmm. Final Fantasy XIV was such a disaster.
Famously,
that,
yes.
Yeah, he was left to go away.
And we also didn't mention the soundtrack, which is so good.
The soundtrack is very good. It's like an upgraded version of Secret of Mana.
I didn't realize I knew all the songs, but when I was playing the game, maybe I listened to the soundtrack a lot, but I was like, I know every song I'm hearing in this game, and I don't know why.
What's your take on the Secret of Mana soundtrack? Do you consider it a classic?
It. Yeah.
I was never really that big of a Secret of Mana, like, original soundtrack fan, yeah.
Hmm.
I like Trials of Mana's soundtrack better, I think.
I like how experimental Secret of Mana's is. I mean, there's definitely some tracks where I'm like, no. I do not want to know about the dwarves anymore.
Yeah.
No. Oh, my God. That freaking dwarf song.
It's like a five-second loop. It's like the musical version of Charlotte.
I mean, there was some music in that game that really was good, but you're right. The freaking dwarf music.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like the harpsichord.
It almost brought down the real
Gamelon. Like, there was really some great stuff.
Yeah,
there.
Sorry to derail the conversation, but I really wanted to talk about the soundtrack because I feel like he learned how to be experimental but not grating, and it's so good. I love the reprisals of old Secret of Mana themes and things like that. It's such a really good soundtrack, and I just listen to it on YouTube all the time when I'm writing and working on things. Very, very cool.
So for Legend of Mana, Koichi Ishii, the original director of Final Fantasy Adventure and Secret of Mana, returned, but he was accompanied by Akitoshi Kawazu, who produced the game, slumming it, I guess, after Saga Frontier. And this game is noticeably not called Seiken Densetsu 4 in Japan. It is treated as a spinoff there. It's Seiken Densetsu Legend of Mana, I believe.
Hmm.
But I have to say that it is like one of the most beautiful games ever created. It's all hand-drawn and painted. The characters look wonderful on screen. The backgrounds are just elaborate and gorgeous. So rustic and so, like, I can't believe they did this.
I think the graphics are technically better. I don't like the character design as much.
Character designs are precious moments. Very, very overly busy with, like, these textures and stuff. They're by Shinichi Kameoka, Whereas the character designs in Trials of Mana were by Nobuteru Yuki, who is a manga artist, anime like character designer. Like he did the character designs for the anime adaptation to Battle Angel.
Also
he did
Escaflowne.
Chrono Cross's Escaflowne. He did Chrono Cross's character designs, all 4,000 of them.
I like that you put Precious Moments in this because I consider this game Precious Moments Final Fight.
It pretty much
with
is.
With an RPG system around it.
Yeah, it's weird because the game is so full of these complex systems and like weird ways that things interwork into each other. And then the combat system, it actually is more stripped down than Trials of Mana. And is literally, it's like, it's Final Fight. You can punch left and right.
And yeah, you go across, like, horizontally on the screen, like a belt scroller game.
Yep.
Sorry, Kat.
Yeah, I was just going to say a beat-em-up is an apt way to describe this game.
It is, except you can choose to have, like, a halberd or a sword or a dagger or whatever. But it's still, like, it's a brawler.
I think looking at this game, so many people fell into the trap of buying it when it came out.
I did.
Because you look at the screenshots in the back of the box and it looks so beautiful, especially compared to so many games that are out on the PlayStation. You're like, well, Square's done it again. Got to buy this game. It's the same with Saga Frontier 2, another game that—
But at least that one has the excuse of being a Saga game.
Yeah.
Weird. Like, if you played Saga Frontier, you knew you were getting something weird.
Yeah, exactly.
This game had a very classy cover in America. There was no guy, like, swinging an axe at you or whatever. It was just, like, very classy and understated, which you didn't really see in American covers back then.
It's very painterly look to Legend of Mana.
I loved Secret of Mana, so I imported this with excitement and spent a few hours with it and thought, you know, there must be a language barrier here because I do not get this game. I don't really know what's going on and why I'm doing stuff. But no, it turns out that's just the game.
Yeah, it's really broken up into a, kind of a series of side quests that doesn't really connect all that well. And so many of the side quests are so perfunctory.
And you can miss a lot of things if you don't play them in the right order, if you don't place the what's called the geo-something system?
Artifacts, yeah.
Artifacts, yeah. Like all the videos I watched about this because I didn't want to try playing it again, they were like, this is the game where you need to look up a fact and say, what do I put down in what order? Because otherwise you're not going to see all the game.
Yeah, so we need to explain this. In Legend of Mana, the world has been basically destroyed. It like opens with this huge whirlwind destroying everything. And you as the player are basically a god, and you're given a blank map and a single artifact that you place, and then that's how you restore the world. You find artifacts by playing, and then you place those artifacts on the world map, and they turn into a location. And these are affected by, like, the nature of these locations are affected by, the elements on that area of the map, and also what artifacts are adjacent to where you place it. And there's probably some other things, like probably the day of the week or something. I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say there's no indication in advance of what you should be doing. It's just like, hey, you got a thing. Go ahead and place it someplace. You don't know what's going to happen.
Now, maybe that's an indication of a game that's a bad guide type game where you're just going, I have no idea what even the basics of these games. Because a good game will lay out the ground rules. And you'll be like, okay, I understand. Here are the ground rules. But there's so much more beneath the surface that I want to delve into. I think like Pokemon is a prototypical example of this. Whereas in Legend of Mana, like so many people pick this game and are like, what? What? I don't know what I'm doing. This is inscrutable.
Well, there's no explanation in game of, you know, like here are some suggestions for how to play advantageously. No one in the game says like, oh, hey, you have, like the wagon wheel. You're going to want to put that artifact close to this other place or in a certain spot because interesting things will happen.
Right. The basic path of success
is
very obscure, I think.
It's funny. I was looking at tutorial videos for this game just to figure out how things worked for this podcast. And I was like, okay, I'll look at the tutorial for like weapon crafting. I clicked on the video. It was 90 minutes long. So maybe the guy just talks slow, but I'm like, this should not take 90 minutes to explain to me like how this one system in this game works out of like 7 or 8.
Yeah, you can find stuff in the world. You can craft weapons. Basically, the hero has a home, like a ranch or something. There's a little cactus inside who writes a diary as you play. But you can capture monsters, and they can fight with you if you want to have them fight with you. You can craft weapons. You can grow plants. You can craft golems who will fight alongside of you. And pretty much all of these systems are optional. I don't think you need to do any of these things in order to win, but they're there. And you can focus tons and tons of time, just lose hours doing these things if you want to.
So it has all of these systems, but the through line, the thread connecting them all is kind of missing.
Right. Kind of like with the quests. There's like three main quest lines, and then there's a bunch of side quests focused around just like random characters in the world that's, you know, you can follow them or not. But ultimately, there's just not too much to be done.
I was curious what people thought of this game and whether or not its kind of reputation had been rehabilitated over the years. And the people who do like defend Legend of Mana actively, a lot of them are in Kotaku's comments because they wrote actually a Legend of Mana is good article because of course they did. there are people who are mostly going, I lost hours and hours and hours and hours just messing around with the almost kind of sandbox-like nature of this game, and there are so many interesting parts that fit together. And I think that if you were looking for a traditional RPG, you're going to be deeply disappointed. If you were looking for almost a sandbox-type game, almost like Minecraft, to mess around with all of the mechanics in the world and kind of explore at your own leisure, you're going to have a much better time. So it was kind of calibrating your expectations. The problem was that the Mana game had traditionally been a very straightforward action RPG. And this is the start of when Mana kind of lost its identity and became this very esoteric experimental thing. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but I do think that it kind of crippled its reach and mainstream appeal as a series and ensured that it never really grew beyond the popularity of the original Secret of Mana.
No, you're really right about that. In 6 years from this game's release, when they rebooted the franchise with like three new games, there was the 4 was sort of like a brawler, right? Like an action brawler.
Kind of with, they called it Dawn of Mana here.
Dawn of Mana.
And again, that had the Havoc physics in it. So there was like a grappling element and you could like pull boxes and enemies and stuff and throw them around.
Right,
and
so it's like a physics-based fighting game.
Yeah, it was
game.
Jurassic Park Trespasser, but in the world of Mana.
So there was that. Amazing soundtrack, by the way. Find that soundtrack. The game does not deserve it. Then there's what was the RTS called?
That was Heroes of Mana.
Yeah.
And that was the prequel to Secret of Mana, to Trials of Mana, sorry.
All people want is another freaking Secret of Mana, and they're making a freaking RTS?
Yeah, and then there was Children of Mana, which was the most traditional Mana-like game, but it was also like a looty game.
Yeah.
I played a bit of that. I did like
Monster Hunter was kind of around, right?
It was around the same time.
It was 2006. Yeah. So Monster Hunter wasn't big yet, was it?
It wasn't, but it was starting down that path.
It was getting there.
On PSP.
Yeah, it's kind of like a randomly generated dungeon sort of game, right?
I think so, but it has like traditional Mana, like Secret of Mana combat. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Legend of Mana and Children of Mana had no story to speak of. Your character here is a boy or a girl, mm-hmm. and they don't really have a personality. They don't have a story to them. It's very different than Trials of Mana, where it's all about each character's individual path and relationship to the villain. Here it's just like you've got a voiceless, nameless avatar who can kill stuff and make golems. And that's it. There are some neat little details. There is no three-player gameplay in this one, unlike the past two games. But you can play two-player. And kind of we were talking about this in the Animal Crossing episode we recorded that's going to be launching around the same time as this episode. You could visit other people's towns in Animal Crossing by putting your character's memory card into someone else's GameCube. You could kind of do that here. You could take your developed character on a memory card, put it into memory slot 2 on the PlayStation, and play with your character in their world of Legend of Mana.
Oh, weird. So, okay.
I don't think anyone actually did that, but it was
I don't think anyone did.
That was right up there with linking two PlayStations together with each with their own TV and fighting each other in first person in Bushido Blade.
Or using your Vita as a rearview mirror in Gran Turismo or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Love those ridiculous ideas. Yeah, so I don't know. There's not really not that much to say about Legend of Mana. Like I don't hate it, but
I mean,
it just never clicked with me.
There's a lot to say, but you have to understand it first, and that I don't think we were equipped to do that because this game, again, like I said, one tutorial for one of like 8 systems was 90 minutes long, and this game was definitely designed for a context of just sitting down, having endless time, being able to prototype things, making your own notes, going onto facts, and I personally didn't have the patience for that in 2000.
And I think it really, in a weird way, bolstered the credentials of Seiken Densetsu 3 because people were going, oh, we got this Legend of Mana, but man, the really awesome true sequel, The Secret of Mana, never came out here.
Yep, but there was one great thing about Legend of Mana, and we're going to talk about that after the break. So the best thing about Legend of Mana is its soundtrack. I have spent, I don't know, maybe like 20 hours with Legend of Mana, and I have spent probably 10 times that with Legend of Mana's soundtrack because I bought the CD and would drive around just listening to it over and over, as with several CDs, soundtracks from this era of Squaresoft's games, because they were just, they were on point, they were on fire, and this soundtrack is spectacular and is really kind of like nothing else that I've ever heard. It's composed by Yoko Shimomura, who you may know as the composer of Kingdom Hearts. But before that, she worked on good games like Street Fighter 2 and some other stuff.
Super Mario RPG.
That was one of them.
Very good soundtrack.
She composed this after like fresh from Parasite Eve. And this soundtrack is nothing whatsoever like Parasite Eve. You would not listen to this and think, oh yeah, that was the Parasite Eve lady. It's totally the opposite of Parasite Eve, which was this kind of like electronica, EDM, operatic, sort of atmospheric, ambient music. It's really hard to kind of put your finger down on Parasite Eve's soundtrack, whereas this one is very much about like a grand sweeping orchestral adventure, and every track on here feels that. There's definitely like texture and some quieter pieces, but on the whole, like the parts that really stand out of Legend of Mana's soundtrack are the tracks that are just like full-on orchestra bombast in your face. And it's – I don't know that there are really many electronic instruments on this. I mean, maybe synthesizers, but they're all trying to be strings and horns and things like that. It's about acoustic guitars and acoustic drums and, you know, woodwinds and reeds and, you know, stringed instruments and orchestration. It is about like, you know – so Parasite Eve takes place in New York City and you're fighting like an unnatural abomination. And I feel like the music reflects that with its techno style and its ambiance and so forth. Whereas Legend of Mana is about restoring balance to the world and it's very pastoral. And that's exactly how the music sounds. It's very like natural and acoustic and grand.
Kind of a departure from your average soundtrack on the PlayStation, because when I think back to the usual PlayStation fare, like a lot of it sounded like heavily synthesized or, as you said, was like in EDM or it was some kind of pop song. So to go full orchestral is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, you didn't really hear a lot of PlayStation music that really sounded like true orchestra. You tended to come up with stuff like, you know, you love Valkyrie Profile. What's that guy's name?
My name.
EY, is that his name? I can't remember. Anyway. His stuff tends to sound very bombastic, but also very synthetic.
Mm-hmm. Synthetic is a perfect word to describe Valkyrie Profile's soundtrack.
Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of synthetic string sound, but this sounds very natural. Like there is a warmth to it, even though it's kind of like in your face a lot of the time and just like, you know, max volume, like blowing out the levels on the peaks on the mixing board and that sort of thing. Like it still feels, I don't know, like you're kind of there, like it's, you know, being performed by real human beings. I don't know if it really was recorded with an orchestra, but it definitely gives that impression.
Recording with an orchestra also just gives a RPG a very traditional flavor. When I think orchestral, I think Dragon Quest. Mm-hmm. So, which is funny because Legend of Mana is anything but very traditional.
Yes, that is true. And it really kind of, you know, the music sort of sets that up. I don't know. It gives that impression because there wasn't a lot of music like this on PlayStation. And at the very beginning, you have a vocal theme with lyrics sung by a woman named Annika Lundberg, who sings in Swedish. Like you don't hear Swedish sung as a language in video games. It's always Japanese or English or maybe some Spanish or I think Suikoden did Portuguese. But that's kind of it. Like Swedish is way, way outside of the FIGS tradition. There's no, you know, it's not
Anya Swedish?
Typical. Isn't she Irish? Anyway.
Let's leave that hanging.
Yeah, I don't know. Correct us in the comments, please.
That was a rhetorical question.
But having this woman with a very beautiful Irish voice singing in Swedish, like it's a language that's not familiar to most people who are playing the game, it just kind of creates the sense of like, oh, this is warm and inviting, but it's also alien. Like I don't know how to identify this language. What is she singing? It just feels, you know, like you're in the fantasy world of Fadiel all of a sudden, where everyone speaks Swedish, I guess.
When I played this, I assumed it was like a made-up Klonoa language for the first time. Like, oh.
Turns out no.
Nope.
People actually do speak this language on the planet. Bob, why don't you cue up this track and let's hear it.
Sure.
Yeah, that's just not like any other vocals you heard. I mean, you had Final Fantasy VII chanting in Latin. You had Parasite Eve with its like weird vocals like Final Fantasy VI. But yeah, it's just it really makes you think, wow, this is different. I wonder what this game is going to be like. And it is different, but maybe not the way you expect and in a way you can relate to.
Well, it clashes with the beauty of this opening song, seeing Comic Sans font on the screen during that opening video.
It meant something different back then.
It did.
Well, actually, you know, it's such a beautiful theme, but isn't this where it – doesn't this play during the opening scene or the cutscene, the CG, where the tornado is destroying the world?
I can't remember. I think so.
It's like, hey, everything's all messed up. Now go save it.
But in a very weirdly upbeat kind of way.
Yeah. I like it. Anyway, so, you know, the game really makes a strong impression right away by basically just kind of – working aside from expectations. And then, you know, basically the entire soundtrack from there kind of takes this sound quality, this vibe, and carries it forward, although you don't really get a lot of vocals until, again, the end.
Funny because I kind of think Super Nintendo with the driving nature of that soundtrack. I can imagine that's the music that would be playing right before our heroes set out on the airship for the first time or something.
So it's funny you say airship because what this makes me think of sonically, really, and also in terms of composition, is Skies of Arcadia. Like that came out the same year on Dreamcast. Came out, I guess, a little after this game in Japan, but I could see this as, or like, imagine this as a theme for when you're flying around in the airship, gearing up for a battle, you know, getting ready to fight one of the Gigases or something.
Weird to think of this game as a contemporary of Skies of Arcadia.
Right? And yet, there we are.
This is a very boring comparison, but it sounds like it would be a future Kingdom Hearts battle theme. Like, I can see how this will transition her into Kingdom Hearts, because mm-hmm. the Super Mario RPG soundtrack is very different, although there's a lot of bouncier songs like you would hear in that soundtrack on this one. But yeah, this feels like her getting ready for Kingdom Hearts in 2 years.
Hmm. Kingdom Hearts was more piano, right?
Oh, I mean, I would say in the battle themes, there were a lot like this, like that were a little more intense.
Oh, that's true, especially in like the towns, like outside of the Disney worlds.
So I said there weren't any electric instruments in this soundtrack, but that's not entirely true. This is called Pain the Universe, and it's the boss battle theme. And I think the use of very obvious electric guitars and synthesizers here is significant, because it feels at odds with the rest of the soundtrack, and it makes you feel like, you know, you are fighting to purify the world or purify the land and restore mana. So when you fight a boss, you have this kind of jarring, discordant sound that doesn't sound like the rest of the world, doesn't sound like the rest of the music in the game. And it really gets across conveys the impression like this is something bad and wrong. So it's a very strident theme, but I think thematically it's really, really strong.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense how the electronic instruments add a bit of harshness. It's not present in most of the other music.
Yeah, it's not just electric guitars, but it's like super overdrive guitar that's
gruff,
like
yeah.
really, really shrill.
Distortion. Yeah.
When I think of Pastoral, I definitely think of that track.
I'm in a pasture and a meteor is falling on me. So, you know, I said there wasn't a lot of other music like this on PlayStation, but, you know, listening to this kind of puts me in mind of some of Final Fantasy Tactics battle themes. Except
yes.
Oh, totally. This especially.
Yeah, the sound quality on that was much more artificial, whereas this is a bit more acoustic and natural in nature. But you can definitely tell that there is some synthesis going on there. I guess maybe that's why it kind of reminds me of Final Fantasy Tactics, because it has that reverb effect and like that little bit of, oh, those aren't real strings. Those are kind of fake. It, like the sound quality, the sampling is way, way better than it was in Final Fantasy Tactics. Like big improvements in 2 years, but still a little bit strident. But
I like how progressive it is.
Yeah.
Like that it's not just so many of these songs, like I feel like would have started and ended on the initial kind of opening. And this one just kept going in rising and falling, and it's a very energetic song in that way.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned the structure, and one thing I notice about a lot of the pieces on this soundtrack is that, you know, when you do hear game music, often it starts like kind of quiet and builds up, but these almost always start big.
With a crash.
And then,
like
then you'll have like a bridge that's quieter and more sedate, and other kind of instruments start to weave in, and then it builds up with that new instrumentation kind of leading into a reprise of the opening, the bombast. So after a while you listen to these, like I noticed as I was putting together the notes for this, it does kind of get to be a little bit samey, but it's also, you know, I feel like it does kind of create like a unified feel for the soundtrack. Like there is kind of this shared structure and thematic approach to all the music. Thank you.
So in it's funny you mentioned Valkyrie Profile earlier. In that game's kind of Japanese country, the main theme of that area is very similar to this, like kind of traditionally Asian or perhaps Japanese, but kind of subdued in a lot of ways, like a lot of negative chords.
Yeah, I would say this is East Asian influenced. It's for one thing, this is a very clear callback to Secret of Mana soundtrack where you had the Fanatics Temple. But the music here is like gamelan style with tuned percussion, a little bit of string, and then like sitar to kind of embellish it a little bit. And I guess there's like the cello underneath also. So it's very kind of minimalist and definitely leans into that East Asian style. It stands apart from the sort of Western style orchestration of the rest of the soundtrack. So you're like, oh, this is a different place in the world. But at the same time, it does kind of tie it back to, you know, if you've played Secret of Mana, you're like, this is familiar.
Very Chrono Cross-y to me.
It's probably the flute there.
Yeah,
the
whatever woodwind that is.
Yeah. But to me, I don't know. Like, I feel like, you know, every soundtrack has to have every JRPG soundtrack has to have the jaunty track, and this is it.
Hmm.
And compared to the really annoying dwarf theme in the Secret of Mana, this is so much more enjoyable. This is like a sea shanty. It's got kind of like that percussive rhythm, like someone's shaking something, and then you have kind of the sea flute or whatever, the reed. I don't know, the kelp whistle.
I like the old sea flute. It's what Popeye played.
Exactly. We called it a pipe, but he knew better.
This sounds very world mappy.
Yeah, I was gonna say this sounds like an airship theme, like you're flying around in the Mana Beast, but you don't fly around in the Mana Beast in this game. So I don't actually know where this is from. It's been a long time. I guess it does have kind of like a Wild West feel to it. Like I could see this in some sort of mesa or butte or something. You know, an old West vibe, desert. Yeah, I don't know. But at the same time, I don't know. It just has a very kind of classic JRPG feel to it.
So yeah, our guest on the Mario RPG podcast, Maddie, said there's a song in Legend of Mana that sounds like it's from this soundtrack, from that soundtrack, and it's this one. This is the most Mario RPG sounding song from that soundtrack.
This also sounds like one of the Disney World themes in the Kingdom Hearts games.
Yeah.
This is like the bridge. This is it. This is the missing piece.
You're right.
At the same time, the melody line in the game sounds very much like Hiroki Kikuta.
Mm.
Like it feels like this is a conscious effort to reach back into the sound or like the melodic approach of previous Mana games.
I think it's interesting that it seems like she's kind of all over the place in some ways in terms of the themes that she's pursuing with these different songs, but there is definitely a real through line in terms of the instrumentation that she goes with in creating this soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really successful in that regard.
Thank you. So I mentioned Final Fantasy Tactics, and listening to this one again, like, it is straight up like the shop theme from Final Fantasy Tactics. I think this is from the home. Like, there's a lot of little incidental themes that are pretty short in this game that are kind of tied to the hero or heroine's home, and like gardening and raising animals and making golems and stuff. And this kind of sets the tone for all of them. Like, play the next one and you'll hear how similar they are.
Yeah, very tactics-y. I wonder if the like instrumentation is the same.
I think they must have used some of the same sound programming, and this is just like a more refined version of the sound fonts or whatever that they used for Final Fantasy Tactics.
I like the title, Dreaming Fruits.
It does sound like there's a watermelon having a wonderful dream right here.
Yep.
What do watermelons dream of?
Electric, I don't know. Fill in the joke.
The electric slide.
The electric slide. There you go. Somebody did it.
I don't know what that means.
I couldn't do improv, so I just made a Mad Lib.
So this is one of the tracks on the soundtrack that actually kind of reverses the usual structure of this soundtrack and is more like a typical RPG theme where it starts kind of slow and then builds up. I think it's interesting, though, listening to this, how much it reminds me of some of the like background ambient music from Parasite Eve, like something about the percussion in there, or the whatever that was, that was kind of like doing the melody and the rhythm at the same time, something plucked maybe. I don't know. It was really reminiscent of some of the electronic tracks that you hear in Parasite Eve while you're exploring. So you can still tell, you know, you're like, oh, yeah, that's Yoko Shimomura doing something different. There's no Aya Brea here. In fact, the heroine doesn't have a name.
You can name her that if you want to, though.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That harp is straight out of Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah.
And I was going to say it sounds like the crystal theme sped up, used as a baseline.
A little bit. I mean, it's kind of the same feel, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that cymbal crash, just start off the song, is happens all over in the soundtrack for the bigger, louder songs.
Yeah.
Well, she wasn't involved in Tactics.
No, she wasn't. That's the interesting thing. Like I said, I think some of the sound programming, either the team or just the libraries and resources they used were similar. You know, there's only so much you can do with the technology of PlayStation. As versatile and powerful a system as it was, it made sense. Like, you reuse engines, you reuse assets. Why not reuse audio effects, sounds? And no shame in that.
What's interesting is that I just keep thinking how it's definitely of the era, but it also has a almost 16-bit feel to it. In a way that the other, say, like Square contemporaries really didn't. Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9 definitely felt like they were on the PlayStation. They didn't sound like their PlayStation or Super Nintendo forebears, where this feels very Super Nintendo Wii.
That's another one that is just totally Skies of Arcadia. I wonder if she was, like, hanging out, having drinks with everyone. They were comparing notes, like, hey, here's what I'm doing.
Was she freelancing at this time, or was she in the thick of it with Square?
I think she was still in the thick of it with Square.
Okay.
I don't know when she went freelance, but...
She did pretty early, like, surprisingly early when I was looking into her career.
Hmm. Well, she was still just working with Square at this point, so...
Yeah.
I don't know. Hmm. I like the emphasis on this one on more like piano and just a single stringed instrument as opposed to a whole orchestra. It creates, you know, something very different from the rest of the soundtrack.
This is where it feels like she's getting more into the Kingdom Hearts kind of thing.
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Especially the title theme, you know, of Kingdom Hearts had that melodic piano approach. So
it does. It, like, every RPG needs the Something Sad Happen song, and this is theirs. And it's definitely in the it fits with the general sound of this album.
The Something Sad Happened.
It really is. Like, I can, like, oh, I got to the village and it burned down or whatever.
I think that's the literal translation of the Japanese track. Ruined Sparkling City is actually Something Sad Happened.
Something Sad Happened.
So we didn't include this in our selections here, but this actually picks up the melody that you hear in, like, the title screen or, like, the very beginning of the game, like the piano.
Yeah, that one. I was wondering where I heard that before. That was in the
It's like the introduction to the game, but this is the I think this is the final battle music where you face off. You basically have to fight the Mana Goddess and destroy her so that the Tree of Mana can be purified and a new goddess can emerge. So it kind of ties everything back and is a more slow building piece. It does build up, like, it gets pretty bombastic toward the end, but it's kind of slower to start and definitely feels like, oh, this is the culmination of everything.
A big fan of that track.
That one is straight up Parasite Eve. This is where you fight Eve in the opera house, and the ultimate baby comes out.
it also reminds me of when Garland shows up in Final Fantasy IX. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very much of that type. But
it's that prog rock orchestra that really
prog rock orchestra with organ, kind of an organ in there. Yeah.
I could just listen to her voice all day. She's got such a beautiful voice.
Reminds me of Yoko Kanno a little bit, with the piano and the wonderful resonant lyrics and everything. Yeah.
I've always wondered what would happen if you get Yoko Kanno and Yoko Shimomura into the same room, because they both, like, they don't create music that's anything alike, but they both have, like, this incredibly versatile skill set. Like, they can basically do any kind of music you want. And it's always really great and suited to the work that it's in.
I mean, you look at the difference between this track and the last one, where you had, I don't know, prog rock organ, and then you had this one where it's the soaring vocals and the piano. And she really shows off the versatility of her skill set with this soundtrack, I think.
Right, but still using kind of like the same set of instrument voices. It's clearly like drawing from the same palette of sounds.
And you hear that theme again, which I guess is the main theme for the game. Does she echo any of the previous composer's music and her soundtrack for this, or just completely off the table?
Like I said, there's you know, we touched on kind of like the gamelan and
right.
stuff. So there's like hints of previous Mana soundtracks. Like she's using ideas, I think, and maybe hints and references, but I don't think there are any straight up reprises of previous Mana music.
It's an interesting
choice. I'm aware of.
It's an interesting choice then to make it all unique, because 3 was just like, well, it's the same guy, but also he's going to remix some of his music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in this case, you know, it's a spinoff and it's a different composer, so it's kind of a little bit carte blanche. And I like that, as opposed to just, you know, well, here's another person doing remixes of familiar music. That's kind of how Square Enix approaches music now for a lot of its games. Like, I know Final Fantasy XIV has a whole lot of remix music from other games. It also has like a dozen soundtracks.
It's real good, though.
We talked about how it obviously pulls some tunes from the sound library, specifically Tactics. But there are also sounds that I don't hear very often on the PlayStation, especially that deep resonant booming bass that you had in the last
the
song.
Cello and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really feel like the soundtrack, even though listening to it closely, you can definitely hear that it's synthetic and processed and everything. It really just puts the capabilities of the PlayStation to their utmost limit, the way that very few soundtracks on the system did. I mean, I'd put it up there with you know, Symphony of the Night and maybe Saga Frontier 2, another game that is beautiful and has a magnificent soundtrack and is also utterly inscrutable. That Kawazu, what a guy. What a crazy guy.
The PlayStation sound chip was quite versatile, I feel. And, I mean, it's probably shooting fish in a barrel to go after N64, but it really is one of the many things that highlights its difference with the N64, because the N64 sound chip, by comparison, was so weak.
I agree. Anyway, that wraps it up for our look at the Legend of Mana soundtrack. We didn't give track names, which I guess we should have done, but it's fine. Just listen to the soundtrack. Like, put it on a playlist or buy the CDs and...
Or give them your own names.
Or ask Siri, what is this song?
Right.
And she'll answer most of the time. Shazam will help you.
Great soundtrack, and I appreciate, thank you, KSO, for giving us the opportunity to revisit it.
A lot of Legend of Mana tracks are on Spotify, by the way.
Well, there you go. That's the way to listen. Anyway, Trials of Mana, Legend of Mana, two kind of opaque games with some weird design choices, but great music, and I am looking forward to seeing the Trials of Mana remake and how that plays out.
I hope it's good.
Me too.
I want to see that game modernized.
I do too.
And I want to hear what the remix music sounds like.
Yes, absolutely.
I also hope it's good. I think the thing that's interesting about these games is they just did so much to determine the future of the series, and maybe not altogether to the good. But at the same time, we like to lionize experimentation around here, and Legend of Mana certainly was experimental, wasn't it?
Absolutely, 100% like Frankenstein in the lab. Anyway, thank you, KSO, once again, for suggesting this topic and for sponsoring Retronauts. Thank you for your support. If you, listener, would like to request a topic, you can do that by going to patreon.com/retronauts and subscribing to the podcast at the Ultra 64 level. I think there might be a slot open right now. It's an opportunity for you to support the show, something that you love because you're listening to it, so clearly you love us, and to hear us talk about a thing that you love as much as the show. It's two great concepts together, us and a thing that you enjoy. Wow.
I'm going to take that slot and make you do that Gundam show that you keep promising.
Cat, for you, I will do it for free.
Oh, thank you.
Cat, but for you.
It's got to wait until next Gundotum.
Half price. Because we like you.
Ultra 32. Anyway, you can also subscribe to Retronauts at a much lower tier of $3 a month to get every episode that we publish on each week on Monday at a higher bit rate, so better sound quality, and without sponsorships and advertisements. And a week earlier than everyone else. That's a pretty cool deal. It supports the show, keeps us going, allows me to fly out here to San Francisco and sit in a studio with Bob and Kat as opposed to having to call in from far away and hope that it works. If you want to really support us, you can subscribe at $5 a month, and that gets you not only the Monday episodes, but also every other Friday you get a free – I guess not free – a $1 per episode bonus.
Once you pay for it, it's free.
It's exclusive to Patreon patrons on Patreon. You also get a weekly column written by Diamond Fight that talks about the most interesting moment of history from the week gone past. And it's a great read every single weekend. So that's a lot of good, cool bonus stuff. Check it out. Anyway, I think that's it for my Retronauts pitches. Everyone, why don't you pitch yourselves?
Hi, I'm Kat Bailey. I'm the editor-in-chief of US Gamer. You should come visit our website. I think that we actually have a lot of really great content on there, spanning a lot of the things that Retronauts fans would like. For example, we just recently did retrospective articles on Mass Effect 2 and Resident Evil 4. The Resident Evil 4 one was one that I actually wrote. It was about how Resident Evil 4 is actually scary. A lot of people like to talk about how it took Capcom in a much more action direction and left behind the horror aspect, but actually I think it's...
I agree.
It really does retain a lot of the horror, and it's actually one of the scariest games in the series. Go check that out. I also run a podcast called Axe of the Blood God. You've probably heard of it. We're currently in the middle of a series called the Console RPG Quest, where we're going through every single console, going back to the days of the Atari and talking about their RPG library and their legacy. Some consoles have a much stronger legacy than others, but it's actually kind of fun to talk about the ones that don't have a super strong legacy, like the N64, because you can kind of go, what the heck went wrong? Why didn't it have RPGs? Where are all the RPGs? So if you are wondering the answer to that question, well, they're all over at Axe of the Blood Gods. Go listen to them.
The answer to that question, Kat, is Quest 64, the only RPG you ever need.
Oh, my God.
At least no one answered that way. Hey, everybody, it's me, Bob Mackey. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcasts are all located on the Talking Simpsons Patreon. That is the Talking Simpsons Podcast Network at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. They're also available for free, and those podcasts are What a Cartoon, of course, and Talking Simpsons. But if you go to the Patreon, you can get all kinds of bonus episodes and miniseries and so much stuff that is not available on the free feed. So please go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet. I'm often on Twitter as GameSpite. You can also find me every Wednesday on my YouTube channel uploading a video about the history of the NES or Game Boy or some other system. Look for NES Works or Game Boy Works or whatever, or just Jeremy Parrish on YouTube. And finally, you can find me at Limited Run Games doing my day job, which is basically doing the stuff that I do here at Retronauts, but for Limited Run Games. It's great, and we'll probably never publish Legend of Mana as a limited edition, but never say never. And if we do, you can... I look forward to that soundtrack. Anyway, thanks once again for listening. Thank you, KSO. And until next time, I got to figure out where the hell to put this podcast artifact.